From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, we'll get the latest on conditions and recovery efforts in both hurricane-ravaged Puerto Rico and earthquake-hit Mexico City. Also today, the Obama administration created the first Atlantic Marine National Monument just last year. It's off the shores of Cape Cod. Now the Trump administration looks to ease restrictions on commercial fishing there.
There's a reason why people fish. They love it. It's a way of life. It's ingrained in their souls. And, you know, it's not that easy just to tell a fisherman to go get another job.
And should Boston bid to be Amazon's second headquarters?
I think that we have a great story to tell. I think that we'll be as competitive as any other bid that comes in from around the country.
Also today, in 1796, Ona Judge was an enslaved woman owned by President George Washington. She escaped to freedom in New Hampshire. Her story and more coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're going to start today with the ongoing devastation in Puerto Rico. The island is completely without power following Hurricane Maria, which made landfall there yesterday as a Category 4 storm, clocking in winds at a staggering 155 miles per hour. And this is just a couple of weeks after Hurricane Irma struck the island, causing as much as $1 billion in damages. Irma gave us a break, but Maria destroyed us, Edwin Serrano, a construction worker in Old San Juan, told the New York Times today. Now, officials say that it could be months before power is restored to the entire island. The dire situation deeply worries the hundreds of thousands of people across New England with strong ties to Puerto Rico. WBO reporter Maria Garcia has been speaking with some of them, and she's here now in the studio. Hi there, Maria.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, you went to Boston South End today, where many in the Puerto Rican community live here. What do they have to say?
That's right, Meghna. I went to Villa Victoria, a Puerto Rican neighborhood, spoke to so many people in markets, at a preschool, at convenience stores, at several restaurants. All of them have relatives in Puerto Rico, at least all of the people I spoke to, all of the Puerto Rican Americans I spoke to. And all of them feel like their hands are tied. Very few of them have been able to speak with their relatives. Unless their relatives have a generator, there's hardly any way for them to get a hold of them. So the hardest part of this is just not being able to do much, but wait and hope for the best.
Yeah, you know, it is almost unfathomable to think about the fact that the entire island is without power. I mean, we've been seeing reports about perhaps officials being able to make contact with folks in the eastern part, but not the western part of Puerto Rico. But of course, it's really hard to say because, as you said, it's hard to connect with people there. So how are relatives, when they can, making those connections?
Right. Well, it's sort of a patchwork of resources that people are using here. Some people are calling Puerto Rico's Federal Affairs Administration that's working to communicate with people in the United States who have relatives on the island. There's one functioning radio station in the island, from what I understand, from people who have been communicating with their relatives there. And that radio station is functioning as a sort of like de facto emergency center, yeah, essentially receiving emergency calls and connecting people with authorities and resources there. But then also, you know, people are just using social media channels. They're using Facebook. Some people are using Twitter, and they're doing what are called the social media chains, where, you know, you put out a call and, you know, that says, hey, my grandmother is in this city in Puerto Rico. Anyone else there? And then people tag, you know, other individuals, yeah, who might be there. And then before you know it, you have a chain of, you know, several hundred individuals on social media who are sharing information on individuals there. And then, like I said, people do have generators. Some residential buildings have generators. Some hospitals have generators. And, for example, a woman I spoke with today, her father lives in a building with a generator that's supposed to last about a week. And then after that, she doesn't know what's going to happen. Her name is Dr. Vanessa Calderon Rosado. She's the CEO of Inquilinos Boricuas en Acción. It's a local nonprofit that advocates for housing and education, all sort of cultural issues for Puerto Ricans here. And, you know, she got really emotional today, Meghna, when she started talking to me about sort of the roller coaster she's been through in the last few days, like not being able to get a hold of her 87-year-old father in Puerto Rico and calling him several times. And finally today she was able to reach him. And she told me about that, if we can listen.
I was able to find out together with my dad today. He's doing good, so that's great. And when we were able to connect today, our call dropped and then we weren't able to reconnect. But at least we were able to talk long enough to know that he's fine and to have a good conversation. So it's very erratic right now. It's very choppy. No, there's no consistent way of communicating.
And Maria, Dr. Calderon Rosado's story seems to be very emblematic of many families, both in New England and Puerto Rico, right? That young Puerto Ricans come to the States, and as she has, her family, her older relatives are still on the island. So how is that sort of affecting what is going to be a long road to recovery in front of the island?
A very long road to recovery. I mean, it could be up to a month or longer before the island has power. A lot of people forget that there are more Puerto Ricans in the United States than there are on the island, where there are 3.5 million people. And Puerto Rico is still in the midst of a recession. The unemployment rate is very high there. They've been in a recession since 2006.
A bankruptcy.
A bankruptcy. And so a lot of young people came to the United States to seek employment, which means a lot of the people who are living in Puerto Rico right now are a lot older. And sure enough, today when I went out to Villa Victoria, a lot of people whom I spoke with have relatives in their 70s, in their 80s. And a lot of these relatives, a lot of these older people don't text, right? So WhatsApp and Facebook are a lot of the platforms that people are using to connect. But these older relatives, they don't use them. They still rely on landlines, which are down in a lot of places. It's tough for people out there.
Well, so in that case then, Maria, I mean, what have you found out about how people can help?
Well, they can donate to UNICEF, to an organization called Unidos por Puerto Rico. And basically, just wait to see how bad the extent of the damage is. I spoke to, like I told you, Dr. Vanessa Calderon Rosado, who told me that when her father explained to her over the phone for the short period of time in which they were able to speak about just how bad it was, she said it affected not just her father, but her, it affected her. And so let's listen to what she had to say about, just hearing about how hard it's going to be to recover.
Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens, and the 3.5 U.S. citizens in the island, I think, has been forgotten and treated as second-class citizens. And the fact that people are really paying attention to this and moving and mobilizing to help the island is really warm, touching and heartwarming for me.
Well, that's Dr. Vanessa Calderon Rosado speaking to WBUR's Maria Garcia. Maria, thank you so much for bringing us up to speed about how the local Puerto Rican community is responding to a truly awful situation on the island. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Meghna.
Well, we are also following rescue efforts following the magnitude 7.1 earthquake that hit central Mexico on Tuesday. It is the country's deadliest earthquake in more than 30 years. Authorities have reported more than 240 deaths in central and southern Mexico, with the largest number of fatalities in Mexico City. Search teams are still working to find trapped survivors, including at least one 12-year-old girl who was caught when a school around her collapsed. Now, there are more than 40,000 Mexican immigrants in Massachusetts, in Boston, around 25,000, many of whom have strong ties to Mexico City. Joining us now is the Consul General of Mexico in Boston, Emilio Rabassa. Consul General, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much, Magna. Thank you very much, Radio Boston, to have me talk with you.
Well, I mean, I presume it's extraordinarily busy, a difficult time for you and Mexican members of the community here. But what have you been hearing from rescue efforts in Mexico City?
Well, at first it was a terrible shock because it was just less than a week that we had another one in the states of Oaxaca and Chiapas in the southeast, and just within a difference of 10 days, it came this one mm-hmm. from another state of epicenter in Puebla, which is close to Mexico City, and this one hit hard Mexico City, more than 200 dead toll so far, and 2,000 injured people, several buildings collapsed and houses, and even some schools like the one you mentioned where this little kid, Frida is her name, in a school called Enrique Retzamen, is being caught. So now the incredible thing is the mobilization of the civil society together with the Army and Navy.
Yeah. I mean, we're seeing extraordinary pictures and videos from Mexico and Mexico City of those thousands. It looks like thousands of volunteers forming bucket brigades even when they have to remove rubble piece by piece from all of those collapsed
exactly.
buildings. Can you tell us a little bit more about the school, though? I mean, what more do we know about that little girl? How close are rescuers to
well,
her?
The latest news is that they are getting close, but yet hasn't been saved. They have kept her talking and alive. They are bringing especially trained rescue teams, highly sophisticated, with trained dogs to go inside as far as they can. And it has become now like everyone in Mexico is just praying and hoping that Frida comes out well. But the thing is that one of the main newspapers, Reforma, just put it out in 8 columns, at least 1 million citizens, that's the estimate of the authorities, have taken the streets to help.
Mm.
They come out spontaneously in a very organized way to help in moving stones, moving whatever of the debris that fell down, or help in taking food and water to the rescue people, or help in the organization
yeah.
of the shelter homes.
Now, Mr. Rabassa, if I may ask, I'm seeing that Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto has declared 3 days of mourning, even as soldiers and firefighters and police and the Navy and all of these volunteers work to rescue and recover those people whom they can. But my question is, you know, of course, relations between Mexico and the United States are rather unique at this point in time. Does Mexico need assistance? I mean, this is a terrible disaster. Does it need assistance from the international community, from the United States? Would it take it if offered?
It would. We have our foreign minister yesterday at the UN General Assembly. First of all, explain what was happening, and then thank all those governments that voluntarily are sending help in the form of specialists in rescue teams. That's and certain equipment We don't need other kinds of things like blankets or sleeping bags. That's been taken care of very well in Mexico. What a government, like, for example, there is a very impressive picture now of the Japanese rescue team, which is already flying to Mexico, and also another team from Israel. No,
yeah.
This is what we've been receiving mainly from the international community.
So specialized help from teams familiar with earthquake disasters. Final question in the last few seconds that we have, if I may. There must be concern of aftershocks here. It's a very active earthquake area.
Very, very severe. All the network of the 50 consulates are in full open 24 hours, 7 days a week to provide information to our connationals here in New England. We've got 70,000 Mexicans living here in Massachusetts, around 40,000, just in Boston, around 25,000. And the type of calls and mails that we have been getting is for people who want to help.
Mm-hmm.
Want to say or contribute with some in some way to the disaster.
Yeah.
No. So that's very encouraging, Magna, that to receive all these numerous calls and expressions of helping.
Yeah.
And what we are doing is channelizing all these through the Red Cross.
Okay.
The most trustworthy institution for these matters. We've given a line.
Yeah.
It says Cruz Roja Donaciones. It's spelled CRUZROJADONACIONES.org.
Right.
It's in Spanish, Cruz Roja Donaciones.
Well,
instead of...
If I may, Consul General, I'm sorry to have to take it back from you there, but we are out of time, and we'll put a link to that information at our website, radioboston.org.
Great.
Emilio Rabassa, Consul General of Mexico in Boston, thank you so very much.
No, thank you very much, Magda, and allow me to thank the Bostonians and the people from all different countries that have been reaching us. We have a book of condolences here in 55 Franklin Street. Thank you very much, all our friends, for all your support.
Yeah, thank you as well. Okay, well, we'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Trump administration is considering allowing fishing in the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts Marine National Monument. That's the first national monument in the U.S.'s Atlantic waters, designated thus last year by the Obama administration. Now it covers some 5,000 square miles just off of Cape Cod. And when President Obama first created the monument, he said he was doing it in a way that, quote, respects the fishing industry's unique role in New England's economy. But many fishing groups disagreed, since the monument designation banned commercial fishing in the area. But again, that could change with word via a leaked memo that current Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke is recommending reopening the monument to fishing. So let's get a couple of views on this. First, from Andrew Rosenberg, director of the Center for Science and Democracy. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Mike.
Also with us is Shannon Eldridge. She is a board president of the Northwest Atlantic Marine Alliance, a fisherman-led organization. Shannon Eldridge, welcome to you.
Thanks.
So first of all, if you could, Andrew Rosenberg, give us your reaction to the possibility of the Marine Monument being open to fishing.
Well, I mean, the purpose of designating the Marine Monument was to protect some rather unique environments where there is very little fishing. There are corals, there's other kinds of unique resources off the New England coast. The whole purpose of the monument was to protect those resources, and while 5,000 square miles sounds large, it's not very large compared to the whole area of the Northeast Continental Shelf. So to allow fishing basically undermines the ability to protect those resources.
And Shannon Eldridge, what's your first thought here? Because I know that many in the fishing community, the fishing industry, strenuously objected to the creation of this marine monument to begin with.
Yeah, so in the first place, declaring a national monument in the ocean is not an effective management tool. Like Andrew said, the canyons are fishing grounds for a smaller group of specifically offshore lobstermen and crab fishermen. But the majority of the fishermen that we work with were not directly impacted by the monument, but we believe declaring monuments sets a precedent that could affect a lot of fishermen. If the government uses monuments as a means to managing the ocean's resources, we believe that we should be part of that conversation.
So Andrew Rosenberg, respond to that. What's your thought on that?
Sure. I mean, first of all, there was a process by which people could submit comments, and fishermen did. There really, as far as I know, there's only one crab boat that's working in that area, although I think a few moved in after discussion of lobstermen might have moved in for some limited fishing after the discussion of a monument came up. So there was a public dialogue. This is not a fishery management tool. There is a process for that. This is protecting a public resource. There are two marine monuments, one in the Pacific and one in the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's all kinds of fishing going on all around all of our coasts. So to confuse this with a fishery management program, I think, isn't appropriate.
Well, so if I could just jump in here, because I want to turn that question back to Shannon and actually add this, because Shannon, part of the thinking behind the creation of the monument from a scientific standpoint is that holding on to these pristine areas of the marine environment would actually help scientists better understand how the oceans are changing because of things like climate change, which are having an impact on the fishing industry. I mean, we have some tape here from Zach Cliver, a naturalist at the Bar Harbor Whale Watch Company, and he spoke with New England Public Radio this week about this issue.
If we have some neutral and pristine ocean environments that aren't stressed, we can study the impact of ocean acidification and climate change, and that's going to help fishing communities. We need to know, will that ecological diversity and biodiversity help create a more stable marine environment?
What's your thought on that, Shannon Eldridge?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, we're all about studying the ocean and, you know, including climate change as part of the conversation. Our organization believes that climate change is a very real thing, but you know, the ocean is a big moving part, and one of the things that we really want to emphasize is scale. So in the case of monuments, we have two kind of very opposing views that are dominating the conversation. One is larger environmental groups are saying, you know, there should be absolutely no human impact on these kinds of ecosystems so that we can study what's going on. And then you have big sort of industrial scale companies and big industrial scale fishing organizations that are saying, well, wait a minute, we should be able to make a living. But we're kind of medium and small scale fishing operations that, you know, are wanting to be a part of the conversation and tell, you know, managers and scientists and help them understand what we're seeing out there.
Mm-hmm.
And that should be a part of the conversation when we're talking about human impact on ecosystems.
Yeah. So, Andrew Rosenberg, on that point, I mean, there is definitely the ideal of protecting, quote unquote, pristine natural environments. But fishing has been going on in the Atlantic for, you know, multiple generations. I think one could make the argument that it is as much a part of the environment as, you know, the fish itself. And to that point, if I could, I'd like to actually play a piece of tape from Beth Cassoni. She's of the Massachusetts Lobstermen Association, talking about sort of how fishing is so integral to the New England marine ecosystem that you really can't separate the two.
If you want to save a piece of coral, people will throw tens of thousands of dollars at it, but if you want to save a fisherman, they'll tell him to get another job, and it's not that easy. I mean, there's a reason why people fish. They love it. It's a way of life. It's ingrained in their souls. And, you know, it's not that easy just to tell a fisherman to go get another job.
Tandri Rosenberg, I wonder what your thought is about that, that there really is no such thing as a purely untouched marine environment that's ever been free of, from human interaction, let alone fishing.
Oh, I think that's right. I certainly agree with what Shannon said. There is a dichotomy here in terms of big industrial operations. Sometimes people arguing for pristine environments, and I also agree with the last speaker that it is very difficult to, you know, tell a fisherman to go do something else. That's not what's happening here with the National Marine Monument. That is a fishery management discussion. I've been involved in those discussions in the past for many years. It's extremely difficult. It's very complex. This is a monument designation in an area where there is almost no fishing currently. That doesn't mean that there's no impact. One of those impacts you already mentioned, climate change, from human activity. There are other impacts out there. This is an attempt to protect an area that has some very unique features. That's not the same thing as saying it's totally pristine.
Right.
Sure, there's good science to be done there, I'm sure, by those people who happen to work on those issues, but this is about protecting a unique national resource that we really don't find elsewhere, and it's not a very large area in that perspective, given that we fish almost everywhere else.
Yeah. If I just may, Shannon Eldridge, the last question goes to you, because right now we're talking about possibly removing restrictions on commercial fishing on the Marine Monument, but as you know, the Trump administration is doing a whole-scale review of many national monuments across the country. I mean, would you prefer that the administration move to totally remove the designation altogether?
So, like I said before, you know, if Zinke and the Trump administration want to open up national monuments and wilderness areas and wildlife refuges and national parks to less prohibitive hunting and fishing, then, you know, we should be talking about scale. We should be talking about, you know, what kind of precedent this will set for the future. And, you know, we should be bringing in the people who are most impacted into the conversation. And for us with the canyons and fishing, is we really need to think about the fish, the people who are making their living in the ocean, and then also people who are relying on fish as part of their diet. We have to remember fishermen are feeding people. And if we start cordoning off the ocean and protecting every single, you know, part of it from all human impact, we're going to lose a big part of our seafood system.
Right. Well, Shannon Eldridge is board president of the Northwest Atlantic Marine Alliance and a commercial fisherman joining us from Chatham today. Thank you so much, Shannon.
Thank you.
And Andrew Rosenberg, director of the Center for Science and Democracy, speaking to us from Cambridge. Thank you as well.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so I know that a little while ago, maybe yesterday, maybe earlier this week, it's been a long week for me already, NPR did a story about a newfangled AI home assistant, one that rhymes with Balexa, and they got a lot of pushback from listeners because the radio story triggered the Balexas in people's homes every time they mentioned the name. So consider this your fair warning. I'm going to give you a second to turn off your deactivate or whatever, your little devices that have been created by a giant jungle named corporation, because I'm about to say its name a lot. Okay? Ready. So here we go. Alexa! Hey, Alexa! Boston wants to become home to Amazon's second corporate headquarters. Does it have a chance?
Sorry, I didn't understand the question I heard.
Yeah, right, Alexa. Come on, the city would be great! I mean, surely, you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
All right, Alexa. I want the truth.
You can't handle the truth.
Yeah, well, actually, we can. And we're having a little fun here because, yes, as you know, Amazon announced this month that it's accepting bids for its second headquarters. It's outgrown Seattle, apparently. And according to the e-commerce giant, the new HQ could bring with it some 50,000 jobs. So Boston and a couple of other Massachusetts cities want to be in the running. And joining me to discuss is not Alexa, but Asma Khalid, head of WBUR's Bostonomics team. Hi there, Asma.
Hey, Meghna.
Also with us is Scott Kersner, innovation columnist at the Boston Globe. Hello, Scott.
Hey, awesome to be here.
I'm glad to have two actual humans here. let's start with you. I mean, Mayor Walsh is keeping the details of Boston's bid under wraps, but what do we know so far?
Yeah, and Meghna, he's saying he's doing this because of competition, right? But obviously there are some folks who raise questions about transparency and sort of memories of the Olympic bid and whatnot. But I will say that, you know, a lot of people, when you talk to them, are proposing Suffolk Downs as perhaps the most likely option for Boston, that this would be an area that would be shared by Revere as well. It is an area of which, point blank, I asked Mayor Walsh on the record if he would confirm it's the leading contender. He wouldn't, but it is a site that's being considered as a very likely possibility.
Okay. So, Scott, you've been writing about this. Spoiler alert, everyone, you don't think Boston's going to get it.
Well, you know, that was my initial reaction the day that they announced this, just because, you know, Seattle has had this explosion of jobs created by Amazon. They have Microsoft right across the bay there in Redmond, Washington. And, you know, it's you know, on the San Francisco trajectory of cost of living and traffic jams. Mm-hmm. And so I just thought, well, maybe Amazon is going to want to diversify and go to a city like a Atlanta or an Austin or a Charlotte, you know, maybe a warm weather southeastern city where people in their 20s just graduating from college can afford to buy a house on a $100,000 salary.
So good weather here. And affordability, you think?
Okay. I just thought about diversifying.
You know, leave the U.S. altogether.
Yeah, well, Toronto to me is the most interesting city because they have a couple strong universities churning out computer science grads, and it would sort of be a big message. I was going to use a finger reference, but it would send a big message to Donald Trump, right, that we want to be in a city that's still in North America, but yeah, where you can hire the smartest people from around the world and not worry, are they going to get a visa to come work for you?
Oh, okay. So that's a good point. But so I was wondering, okay, coming back here to Boston, to yes, be parochial about the whole thing. I mean, I feel like there are the very strengths that Boston has might also be the same weaknesses that Boston has as a potential site. Well, like, okay, we've got tons of smart people, but we've got a really low, you wrote about this, Scott, that the unemployment rate's really low now, so Amazon would have to be poaching to fill those 50,000 jobs.
Maybe, right? But like, I will say that every time you talk to tech leaders here, you're presented with sort of this two-problem situation. One is you'll ask them, you know, why they came here or what's so attractive about being in Boston, and they will say, the tech talent. And then the second problem they will say, you'll ask, you know, well, what's sort of the dynamic of hiring people? And then they'll insist that it's the tech talent. They can't find enough of it. And so I was speaking with one person earlier today in the tech community who said, in some ways, a lot of people are really excited about even just the prospect of Amazon having a headquarters here because they think it would create a lot of buzz. It sort of gives Boston this affirmation. You often hear from people about the number of computer science degrees, you know, people who have MBAs who graduate from universities here and then hop up on a plane and leave the area the next week after. And so there is this sense that maybe having Amazon headquartered here or even its second headquarters here would be this stamp of approval, giving Boston sort of, I don't know, just creating maybe more of a reputation image that people would want to stay in the area.
Come on, Scott. What do you think?
Well, I've talked to people who subscribe to that kind of rising tide theory, right, that Amazon will give Boston a seal of approval.
That is the way people say these days, yeah.
To come here, yeah. Rising tide lifts all boats. And here's something interesting, just kind of going back into history. I thought Jeff Bezos, Amazon CEO and founder, hasn't had a high profile in Boston. You know, he doesn't come here to speak at conferences. Mm. He hasn't given a commencement address like a lot of the other tech CEOs, Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook. But when you go back and you look, Bezos knows a lot about the academic environment of Boston. He's bought a handful of companies, five or six companies, including the robotics company Kiva Systems that now supplies robotics technology for all their warehouses. He also, I got someone to send me a list. Bezos hosts this really exclusive conference in Palm Springs once a year called Mars, and it's all about machine intelligence and robotics and space. Only invites 100 people. 20 of those 100 people are from Boston.
Oh,
right?
Okay.
So this is someone who understands like how much forward-looking intellect in academia and in the business world are in Boston.
Okay, so but what about the What about the politics around this, right? Because even with the whole GE relocation, it wasn't as if every last Bostonian welcomed the company with open arms, right? I mean, there, people are still grumbling about the incentives that the city and the state handed over. I imagine that for a new HQ, the size of which Amazon is talking about, the incentives would have to be enormous, which A, is Boston going to even like offer the most? And B, does a company want to come in when they're pretty much guaranteed that a lot of people are going to be complaining about it?
Yeah, I mean, those are two really good questions. I think that politically speaking, it's also why we're seeing the mayor be somewhat closed, you know, and somewhat secretive at this point with what the bid will actually entail. Yesterday, I spoke with him and he mentioned something in passing about, you know, in the initial bid, we're just not really focused on tax incentives. We're just not thinking tax incentives. And I stopped him and I said, no tax incentives? And he said, yeah, no tax incentives. And literally within 10 seconds, he said, nah, but that'll probably change. You know, that could change. And it's the idea, though, that politically, it's not a very wise move to start talking about the incentives, because as you mentioned, people are still grumbling over what GE got. That being said, when you do push sort of non-political leaders, maybe people in the business community, you will hear from them that, yes, financially speaking, if Amazon is going to employ 50,000 people here, that means that the tax base in the state increases and the state or the city is likely going to have to offer a larger tax incentive.
But the argument that you're making to the taxpayers is we're going to shell out, you know, not shell out this money, but sort of, you know, give this break to a big company. And trust us, the tea is going to get better. Mm-hmm. The roads are going to get better.
Yeah, the schools are going to get better.
Right, housing, you know, will be more affordable somehow.
Yeah. And so the number with GE was $145 million between the city and the state tax breaks. You know, is $500 million, is $1 billion going to fly in Massachusetts? Wisconsin offered $3 billion for this
Foxconn
factory. I just don't see that kind of, I don't see a number with a B really working in Massachusetts.
You could make the argument, though, that Boston, unlike some of these other cities, does have some of the inherent qualities that Amazon is looking for when it comes to, say, talent in particular, and that perhaps it could get away with a somewhat smaller tax incentive.
I actually think the bigger incentive you could justify if Amazon would take a site in a place like Lawrence or
Haverhill.
Well,
I was just going to ask about
that. Up on 495, yeah. Because they would get the brownie points for saying, we're going to come into a mill city, you know, a formerly great industrial city, and we're going to revive it, much the way Manchester, New Hampshire has been revived by tech companies and by Southern New Hampshire University there. And, you know, you say you're not in Boston, but you're really accessible to people who live in the northern suburbs and in Andover and southern New Hampshire. There's a lot of techies in southern New Hampshire. And Amazon already, I mentioned this robotics company they acquired. They're in North Reading. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you could imagine a location midway between the airport in Manchester, the airport in Boston, Hanscom Airport for private, you know, your private jet needs.
I mean, and you know, in a place where it's affordable or more affordable, obviously. I mean, have you spoken to folks up in Lawrence?
I spoke with the mayor of Lawrence last week when sort of we first heard the talk of this joint bid between Lawrence, Haverhill, and North Andover. And, you know, he talked, yes, about sort of the affordability. He mentioned that they just have a large workforce. And on this point, I would say I somewhat disagree with the mayor. I think he was specifically talking about the fact that Lawrence has had a relatively high unemployment. But the issue there is that I think where the sort of workforce of Lawrence is, it doesn't exactly match the needs that Amazon is looking for.
But they could draw that workforce in, though, right?
True, but what does that mean for the current, you know, population of Lawrence that is a largely immigrant workforce at this point that isn't as highly educated?
So last question for both of you, because, I mean, I don't know how I feel about this, because I'm always dubious about the incentives that states and cities give and whether or not we actually get what's promised in return in terms of development. But on the other hand, unlike GE, Amazon is very much a 21st century company. I mean, it's changing how we live. I mean, there's a certain amount of cachet for being the place where that development is happening, isn't it? Just, shouldn't we fight for that?
You know, the smartest thing that's been said to me on that topic is from a guy named Russ Wilcox, who ran the startup that supplies the screen to all of the Amazon Kindles. So he's interacted with the company. He's met with Bezos. And he basically said, imagine if another city gets this other headquarters. Imagine if it's Pittsburgh. Imagine it's Chicago. And where does that leave Boston? Does that make us feel like, oh, we've fallen a few notches further behind in, you know, in the tech race?
Does it? Would it?
I heard that similar point from a tech leader as well, concerned that if Boston doesn't get it, would it essentially perhaps even limit some of the tech evolution that the city's seen to date? I don't know.
Wow. Well, we'll have to ask Alexa. She'll know. Aswa Khalid, head of Bostonomics, WBUR's business and tech team, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And Scott Kersner, innovation columnist for the Boston Globe. It's great to see you again, Scott.
Same to you. Thanks, Meghna.
All right. Well, we'll have you back soon. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Finally today, let's listen back to a conversation we had with historian Erica Armstrong Dunbar. Earlier this year, she joined us to talk about her book, Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. That book is now long listed for a 2017 National Book Award. And in it, Dunbar takes us back to 1796, when President George Washington and First Lady Martha Washington lived in the nation's capital, then Philadelphia. Washington's presidency would end the next year, and the first family had planned to return to their Mount Vernon estate. Now, the Washingtons, of course, owned slaves, and they'd planned to return to Virginia with the slaves they held at the president's mansion. But 22-year-old Ona Judge did not want to return to Virginia. She wanted her freedom. In May 1796, Judge escaped. She found her way to New England and made a place for herself in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. The Washingtons pursued Judge, but never captured her. However, it was not for want of trying, because in the waning days of his presidency, George Washington used the full force of the federal government to return Ona Judge to slavery. He failed, though he continued to pursue Judge unsuccessfully until the very day he died. Historian Erica Armstrong Dunbar joined us in March when her book first came out, and I asked her to tell us more about Ona Judge.
Ona was one of hundreds of enslaved people who were born or brought to Mount Vernon. She, I think important to note is that she was technically the property of Martha Washington. Mm-hmm. She had been passed down, or rather her mother had come from Martha Washington's first husband's estate. Martha Washington came to Mount Vernon, brought Ona's mother, Betty, with her. And Betty would go on to have some kind of encounter or relationship with a white indentured servant named Andrew Judge. And Ona was born at Mount Vernon at the age of 10. She went up to the mansion house to serve Martha Washington and sort of moves up in the ranks and becomes basically Martha Washington's top slave.
Mm.
And she would also sort of take on the responsibilities of being a seamstress and a spinner, but she would do the most kind of intimate chores, helping Martha Washington bathe, or brush her hair, fix her clothing. She knew her mistress well.
Yeah. Well, in 1789, after George Washington becomes president, the first president, you write in your book that Martha actually reluctantly joins him in the then first capital, which was New York. We're changing capitals a lot here in the early days of the country. What was that reluctance all about?
She referred to her days in the North actually as the lost days. She'd shared her husband with the nation for years during the American Revolution, and she worried about George Washington's health, and she didn't want to leave Virginia. She wanted to stay, and so she had no kind of control over her ability to stay. And so Washington actually goes to his own inauguration alone.
Huh. Well, I guess maybe what I should have asked more specifically is, given that they were slave owners, both in New York, but maybe especially in Philadelphia, things are complicated regarding like Philadelphia as a city and slavery. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there were differences clearly between New York and Philadelphia. Yeah. And I think the Washingtons really kind of run into a roadblock with slavery when they come to Philadelphia. The nation's capital moves again in 1790. And the Washingtons take 9 enslaved people with them to Philly. And the laws of Pennsylvania say that you can't hold an enslaved person there. If you're a non-resident, you can't bring your slaves with you for longer than 6 months. And if you do, they have the opportunity to find freedom. So George and Martha and their secretary, Tobias Lear, purposefully rotate their slaves in and out of Pennsylvania. They write to each other that they want to keep it discreet. So he's not actually breaking the law, but he's definitely breaking the spirit of the law. So he would rotate Ona Judge and her other enslaved companions every 6 months back to Virginia or to New Jersey if a trip to Virginia was too difficult.
Now, when Ona was in Philly, did she see, do we know if she saw firsthand? There were free blacks living in the city at the time.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, Philadelphia was the epicenter for black freedom and had more free blacks than anywhere else. Yeah, she saw it in the streets. She saw black entrepreneurs. She saw Richard Allen building Mother Bethel Church around the corner. There was no way to keep her from that. She saw it.
I mean, I cannot imagine I don't even know what to call it, the internal conflict, crisis, sense of what do you call it when you know you are being kept an enslaved person and you see the possibility of your liberation just right there on the street every day when you leave the house with the person who's your owner.
Yeah, I think that it shows the complexity of slavery, right? It's that Ona Judge would live 7 years in the North and really came of age at this moment from the age of 16 to really 22 or so. And she sees black freedom around her. She also sees white men and women being paid a wage. So there's a wage labor system that's now in place. And it affects her and it helps pull the trigger on her decision to free herself, or at least to steal herself from the Washingtons.
Wow. And so when and how did she decide then to pursue her freedom?
She finds out that she's going to be given away. She's going to be given away as a wedding gift to Martha Washington's granddaughter, a woman who was about the same age and who was known for having a kind of volcanic temper. And that decision, that change in her ownership, in addition to her experiences in a free North, made Ona make the decision, I just cannot stomach my enslavement anymore. And she turns to a free black community in Philadelphia for help.
Yeah. Wow. And how does she make her way to Portsmouth then?
Yeah. So she, luckily for us, Ona leaves behind two interviews at the end of her life. And she tells us in these interviews that it's the free black community of Philadelphia that helps plan her trip. She says while the Washingtons were packing their things to go on their summer trip, she was packing her things to go too. She didn't know where. But eventually the free black community would help her. She doesn't give names because it's a federal crime to help or aid a fugitive slave. The only name she gives us is the name of the ship captain, John Bowles, who I was able to trace his ship into the port of Philadelphia in May of 1796. She gives us his name in her interview because he's deceased. She tells us that they were the ones, that it's the free black community and John Bowles who ferries her to freedom or a semblance of freedom in Portsmouth.
Mm. There's so much more I want to cover with you, and we're fast running out of time. I'm getting greedy now. But, you know, it's easy to at a distance to try to paint a life in freedom as one of a grand transformation that's so much better. And, of course, by definition, it has to be better because she was no longer enslaved. But was her life any easier in Portsmouth?
Yeah, I think it's actually, I mean, a decision not to use the term free or freedom in the title of the book. The book is called Never Caught for a reason, because Ona was actually never free.
Okay.
And what the book does is dismantle this myth about what freedom in the North supposedly was. Ona would live for half of a century as a fugitive, constantly looking over her shoulder and really forced to live a life of poverty and great hardship. But she says in her interviews, she would do it all again, that it was worth it, that the material goods meant nothing.
So tell me more about this, you know, half a century living as a fugitive. And for much of that time, or part of that time at least, I mean, it's the president of the United States who's using all that's at his disposal in terms of the power of the federal government to chase her.
Yeah, he turns to the Secretary of the Treasury. He turns to customs collectors in Portsmouth. And all of this, by the way, is documented by Washington's own hand. So this is me using his words.
And so what does he say?
He says, go get her. He says, you know, my wife is very desirous of seeing her again, and I'd like you, we're going to do this under the most discreet, quiet manner possible. go-getter, and for as little cost as possible as well. And what's so interesting here is that it's a moment where George Washington clearly does break the law. He breaks the fugitive slave law, which set into action a process, a procedure in returning the enslaved who were fugitives. Lawyers and magistrates were to be involved, and Washington wanted none of that.
Hmm. And this is a pursuit that he maintained until he died.
Pretty much. He dies unexpectedly in December of 1799. We have correspondence that says up until September, he's still pursuing her.
So, but did his death then proffer Ona true freedom?
No, it doesn't, because the thing to remember is that Ona was actually the property of Martha Washington.
Yeah.
And while we know that George Washington emancipates his slaves in his will following the death of Martha, Martha sets no one free. So none of the property passed down from her first husband to her grandchildren or anyone she bought outright was ever free. So while Ona would have known that the president had died, she also knew that it didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
It did not set her free. And so even though we have not come across accounts of people going after her, she lived with the understanding that she was someone else's property, and any children that she had were also fugitives.
Wow. Wait just a couple seconds. Can you just give us, like, what's one of the lessons that you draw from Ona's life?
Strength and resistance, you know, for her, it brought her something close to freedom, and she never regretted it.
Erica Armstrong Dunbar is a professor of Black Studies and History at the University of Delaware. I spoke with her back in March when her book, Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge, first came out. It's now long listed for a 2017 National Book Award. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.